Hey, it's Zach from Vernacular Podcast and Third String. If you're listening to this, you've clicked play on one of our basketball podcasts on the Third String feed. And I'm telling you that there's going to be a lot more of this because we're moving our basketball podcast, Takes of the Game, to the Third String feed. So now you can hear Third String, our football show, Full Count, our baseball show, and now the Takes of the Game with Taylor Young and Ishan Knapp, all on the Third String feed. So starting September 10th, we are going to be no longer updating the Takes of the Game feed. All of that content will be right here for your listening pleasure. So thanks for listening and enjoy Takes of the Game.
To the Takes of the Game podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Young. On the other line, as always, we got Ishan Knapp. How are you, man?
I'm good. I'm not a Spurs fan, so I'm not in a state of sadness right now, I guess.
What are you talking about? We had a massive free agent signing this week in Quincy Pondexter coming to San Antonio, so everything is all right in the silver and black.
That is not the Spurs story I thought would be on your mind.
Yeah. Quincy Pondexter, I'm ready to deep dive on him for about 30 minutes, talk about his contributions to the 2013 Grizzlies Western Conference Finals appearance team. No, not really. I'm pretty sad because my beloved Manu Ginobili retired, announced his retirement after a 23-year professional career. It's been a rough summer of instability in San Antonio. So, I guess first, what, as a non-Spurs fan and just a basketball fan in general, what did Manu sort of mean to you, or what are your thoughts on him?
What are my thoughts on Manu? I mean, I guess I don't have any like deep thoughts. I think he's a great player. He's fun to watch. One thing that's interesting about Manu is that he kind of connects to our conversation last week. I was watching the debate play out on Twitter today about how great Manu's career was. Is he a Hall of Famer, etc.? And there were a bunch of people who were like, oh, he never scored 20 points per game, never had 5 rebounds or 5 assists per game, and just kept throwing out these like traditional counting stats and being like, oh, Manu wasn't that good because he didn't put up these huge numbers. But then the advanced stats people actually love Manu. Like, I saw some of like the lineup database stats think that Manu had like a better career than Kobe Bryant or whatever. I didn't go deep into exactly which stats said what, but I think it's a great example of like the way Ginobili impacted the game was subtle in a lot of ways. And it was cool how a lot of what was great about him is that he was so flexible and had no weaknesses. Like, he could play on the ball, make plays for others, score himself. He could shoot from distance, which made him valuable off the ball. He moved well without the ball. He's a good team defender. He's a good individual defender. He's, you know, in the passing lanes, poking for steals, but not over gambling. So in a lot of ways, he just did kind of everything right on the basketball court. And even though he wasn't out there, he wasn't basically, it's kind of a weird Hall of Fame type career because he came off the bench for a lot of his career. And, you know, he only, I don't know exactly how many All-Star teams he made, but it was only a couple. And he was never among the leaders of the NBA in any usual measured category. So in some sense, even though his career started like 10 years before the advanced stats thing made it big, Manu's kind of the face of like, if you're analyzing basketball and not just kind of glancing at the box score, you understand that he's one of the greatest players ever. But if you're kind of just glancing at the box score, you might underrate him a lot.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about him and what's weird when people make those arguments like, oh, if there was, he's definitely in the Basketball Hall of Fame, but if there was an NBA Hall of Fame, he shouldn't be in. Because people really look at those on the surface stats. Well, one, he came off the bench unselfishly his entire career, starting in his very early prime. And two, it's interesting that people don't use those, maybe some people do, but people don't really use those same numbers arguments against Tim Duncan. People pretty much always put him in the top seven, top eight players of all time. Whereas, you know, Popovich and the Spurs system really hurt people's individual stats. You know, I think Manu absolutely would have averaged over, you know, 20 points a game for multiple seasons had he been in a non-Spurs-centric system where he didn't come off the bench. I don't think Manu's as talented of a scorer and as talented of a player as James Harden, but the similarities are there. And you look at the way James Harden's numbers, just from a literal points per game perspective, jumped up so dramatically once he left Oklahoma City as their sixth man and went to the Rockets as a starter, and I think, and as their main guy. And I think if Ginobili had ever had the opportunity to do that, he would have just completely dominated the stat sheet. He had some amazing duels and some nights early in his career where he was fully capable of putting up big numbers. The 48-point game in Phoenix, the year Phoenix was incredible in 2005, really stands out. And then he had a duel in 07, I believe, where he outscored LeBron in Cleveland and put up almost 50. So he could absolutely put up stats. It's just the Spurs system held him back from doing so.
I mean, Duncan did put up more traditional stats than Ginobili. I was just glancing at his career stats, and he had like 9 seasons of at least 20 points and 10 rebounds. So I feel like it was easier for people to see what Duncan was doing a little bit.
Yeah, but you also see Tim's, you know, stats really drop off kind of as the Spurs became less of just a Tim Duncan-centric team. I think starting in about 05, in 05 in the finals against the Pistons is really where, I mean, the Spurs don't win that series if Manu Ginobili doesn't just completely go supernova. Tim Duncan was playing on 2 bad ankles. I think Manu, the first 2 games, scored over 25 points in both of those games and only missed 2 shots in the 2 games in San Antonio, and the Spurs went up 2-0 and then had a great game 7. So I was going to talk about this in a second, but I was going to share my top 5 Manu memories. Could probably talk, you know, share 20 Manu memories. But regarding that series, the crazy thing about Manu was he was really loved by San Antonians and Spurs fans in almost like a romantic type love, whereas Tim Duncan was always looked at kind of this infallible figure who you sort of worship from afar. Like, I never remember getting mad at Tim Duncan, but Manu, like, I cursed all the time, but at the same time, he would do things that would just like set my heart completely on fire as a fan. And I remember I went to the Spurs parade on the Riverwalk after they beat the Pistons in 2005. I was 15, and Tim Duncan obviously won finals MVP. And I remember Manu coming by in his float, and just everybody there, thousands and thousands of people starting to chant MVP for Manu Ginobili, because a lot of people felt like he should have won MVP for those finals. And that's just so crazy to imagine a fan base that had Tim Duncan, one of the greatest, most stable players of all time, not turning on Tim, but clearly like chanting MVP at another guy who didn't win MVP. And I think that's just the effect he had on Spurs fans, where it was this more passionate, just, I don't know, electric, just kind of love and support. And I think, you know, people call the Spurs boring, and a lot of times they were, but Manu was really that personality and that flair that I think that team needed. And I think that the fans needed too, because, you know, really until later in Tim Duncan's career, you never really felt like you could relate to him. Tony Parker always felt a little different too, but Manu, with the, you know, Spanish speaking and being from Argentina and being able to relate to the city and just the way that he played, he just has such a profound impact on Spurs fans. And like, I always kind of equate a Spurs fan's love of Manu to how someone feels about their spouse. Like, it's like there are times where it's like this person is just the best thing to ever happen to you and just so amazing, and all you want to do is be near them and think about them and talk about them. And then there are other times where you're like, I want to be as far away from you as possible. And Pop even had similar comparisons to Manu, because Manu lost so many games for the Spurs, but he also would do things that only he could do that would cause the Spurs to win and be set up in these amazing opportunities. So, yeah.
Should we do these top 5 Manu moments?
Yeah. So my number 1 memory, and I couldn't even pinpoint what game this was if I tried, but I know it was the
Wait, first... shouldn't we start from number five?
I'm just kind of going in chronological order. I didn't rank them. So my favorite or my first Manu memory would be when I was in eighth grade, I believe it was Manu's second season. And it was the year that we really started going to probably 10 games a season, had a mini season ticket package. We had Upper Deck kind of nosebleed seats. And I remember Manu goes down the court and he was always the king of trying to maximize 2-for-1 possessions. They were playing Portland. I think Portland had Zach Randolph at the time. And it was towards the end of the half. Manu shoots a three, makes it, gets fouled, goes to the free throw line, misses the free throw, and he like basically curses or like yells as he misses the free throw, runs, gets the rebound, goes to the corner and shoots a three and gets and makes it and gets fouled again. And I think makes that second free throw. But I just remember me and my dad just like laughing. And I feel like that was like the moment, like I realized like what type of player he was. And just like there was only Manu would do something like that, like be smart enough to realize that there's a 2-for-1 possession, which, you know, he did all throughout his career, even to when he was old, and then got like competitive enough to get his own rebound and do the exact same thing again. And he was just always pushing himself. And I know Jeff Van Gundy said besides Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, Manu Ginobili is the most competitive person that he had ever seen play the game of basketball. The second one would have been him getting MVP chance at the finals parade after they beat Detroit. And then the next one would have been in 2013. He on a 2-for-1 possession in double overtime in game one against the Warriors flubbed. We had a 5-point lead, flubbed this possession, shot this errant three, and Warriors got the rebound, ended up taking the lead, and Manu shot a three with like 0.5 seconds left to give the Spurs the victory and steal a game that the Warriors absolutely should have won. I remember Pop after the game saying he went from wanting to kill Manu to wanting to cook him breakfast. And that just like, you know, shows again how I feel like Manu has such a profound effect on Pop and on Spurs fans. That was constantly how people felt about him. Did you see when Manu slapped the bat out of thin air? Have you ever seen that highlight?
I think I've heard about it, but no.
Yeah, so a bat got onto the AT&T center court, I believe in 2008, and it was just flying around and they had to stop the game, and Manu swatted it out of thin air and I believe killed the bat. But I think like he's literally the only player in the history of the NBA that I believe could have done that. Like, do you have somebody that you would nominate as a potential bat swatter?
I feel like I'm not. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there are a number of guys who'd be brave enough to swat a bat. Seems like Joakim Noah or Jimmy Butler would swat a bat out of the air.
I don't know. Jimmy Butler would probably just Instagram post about the bat after the game and about how just kind of give some subversive some sub tweets at him. So,
oh my God. I don't trash talk the Spurs on here. I could.
Yeah. Well, hey, you've been
put together an entire roster of mid-range jumper shooters in 2018.
Hey, we zag when the rest of the league zigs. So, and then my last memory would have been the time that Manu Ginobili literally made me weep in game five of the 2014 finals when he dunked on Chris Bosh. And that was the absolute moment that I knew that they were taking the championship home. It was just such a beautiful arc of redemption for him after he played pretty terribly in the 2013 finals, and a lot of Spurs fans, myself included, were kind of hoping that he would retire. But he ended up lasting longer than Tim, Tony, Danny Green, and even Kawhi, which I would not have put money on back when they lost the finals to the Heat. But I mean, there are so many other memories that I can think of. I am lucky that I really feel like he'll be somebody that I think about the rest of my life. And I you know, gonna have probably Spurs tickets for as long as I live in Austin. And I shared with you the games that we drew and for this season, and it's gonna be really sad realizing that, you know, never gonna see him play again. But I'm lucky that I really got to see his whole career. And I think what's been interesting about this summer is realizing that my era of the Spurs is over. I'll always be a Spurs fan and, you know, I'll always care about them. But like these players that I had this deep connection to that era has ended. And I probably won't have an emotional connection with another group of players like I did, because, you know, Manu, Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, David Robinson, all these guys, like I grew from like idolizing them when I was a kid and even a little kid to respecting them and wanting to like emulate them as men, and maybe not Tony Parker, but the other guys definitely. But yeah, it's just realizing that sort of a chapter on my life that's closing. So I guess that's all I have to say. I'll probably keep talking about Manu on this podcast, though. Memories will always come back.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely know the feeling about kind of emotional involvement in a team. I feel like that's what's missing with me for the Bulls these days, is I just don't care. Like, I watch all the games and I like care about the Bulls being good in the abstract, and I care about them winning in some sense, but like I don't care about any of their guys. Like, there's nobody on the Bulls where if they got traded to another team, I would ever be like, oh, like I'm gonna root for them because they used to be my dude. And it's like, for me, it's not even so much correlated with winning. It's just like, how much did I get invested in this person when they were representing my team or my city or whatever. So it's cool for the Spurs that you got to have both for like 20 years. You got to have a lot of winning, 5 titles, but also guys who, you know, you, like you were saying, you felt like they represented you well.
Yeah. One memory that I should have mentioned is when he blocked James Harden last year in the playoffs. That was incredible to end game 5. So I'll always remember that.
The Spurs played the Rockets in the playoffs last year?
Yeah. You don't remember when we blew him out by 38 in Houston in game 6 to close the series out?
That was like 3 years ago, right?
No, it was last year.
No. Last year, the Spurs lost to the Warriors in the first round of the playoffs, and the Rockets played the Timberwolves, and then the Jazz, and then the Warriors.
Sorry. By last year, I mean 2017. I'm still not... This past season ended too recently for me to call it last year. So,
wait, 2017.
Two seasons ago.
When the Spurs beat
the Rockets, and then the Warriors beat the Spurs in the Western Conference Finals after we beat the Rockets, and Zaza, Nancy Kerrigan, Tanya Harding, I guess, Kawhi. So,
yeah. I do remember that. All right, do you have any more Manu thoughts to share?
Don't. I love you, Manu.
What I want to tell people about is that the WNBA playoffs are straight fire right now. We had a super unfortunate event last night that might take away from them, but it looks like might not have been as bad as we thought. So what's cool about the semifinals right now is that it's a ton of new blood.
Yeah, give us a rundown of the 4 teams.
So we have the Washington Mystics and the Atlanta Dream on one side, and the Seattle Storm and the Phoenix Mercury on the other side. And as our listeners know, the last 3 finals have been between the Minnesota Lynx and the LA Sparks, neither of whom made the semifinals this year. So we got a lot of young teams, a lot of new contenders, and then one not so young team and not so young player in Diana Taurasi trying to have, I don't want to say a last gasp because she looks like she has a lot left, but I think she's
Has she won a title before?
Diana Taurasi has definitely won titles. Let me look this up. So, I'm Googling this right now. I know she's won titles. I'm just trying to look up the years. Yeah, she was WNBA Finals MVP in 2009 and 2014.
So you said we have the Dream, the Mystics in the Eastern Conference, and who is in the West?
So they don't have, the playoffs are not done by conferences. The dream, it just happens to be the case that it's two Eastern teams and two Western teams playing each other. So the Dream and the Mystics won game one, and then late in game two, it was a close game, and Elena Deladon, their leading scorer, went down with what looked like a devastating season-ending knee injury. Deladon, of course, a former MVP herself. And so the Dream squeaked out game two, 78-75 in a close one, and it looked like they might have a clear path to the finals. But now, just today, the newest report is that Deladon actually just has a bone bruise in her knee, not a torn ACL or anything as bad as it looked like it could be. And she's questionable for game three. So this is a best of five series. So think game three is like game five of an NBA best of seven type series. And now, like, the best player in the series is questionable for game three. And so kind of Deladon's health is like the overarching story there. And then on the other side, the Seattle Storm, of course, who had the best record in the regular season this year at 26-8. And the Mercury, the Storm had games one and two at home, had a comfortable looking win in game one, although the Mercury made it close at the end. So the Storm are led by MVP Brianna Stewart, who is 24 years old in her third season. She won four NCAA titles in college. She's won an MVP already in her third professional season. She's won an Olympic gold medal, maybe two Olympic gold medals. So Brianna Stewart already on her way to having one of the best careers we've ever seen. Ironically, playing a woman who many consider to be the greatest WNBA player of all time, and Diana Taurasi. And game two, let me tell you, Taylor, was probably the best basketball game of the entire year. The Storm had a 17-point fourth quarter lead. It might have been more, actually, at one point, but they were up 17 with about 5.5 minutes left. And the Mercury came all the way back. Taurasi, with 2 minutes left, down by nine, pulled up, got to the basket and got a layup, cut it to seven, and then they were down, still down by seven a few seconds later, and she pulled up from about 28 feet behind a screen for a three-pointer from the top of the key, and then still down by six with 31 seconds left, she came off a screen on the left wing at full speed and hit another off-balance sort of fadeaway three to cut it to a three-point game, and then to top it all off, with under 10 seconds left, Taurasi took a dribble handoff on the left wing, took two dribbles with three defenders in her area, down by three, and with defenders all over the place falling out of bounds, hit a fadeaway three to tie the game with 3 seconds left. And it would eventually go to overtime. So this is just really, down the stretch, Taurasi was just hitting, you know, I guess you can call it like cheat code or whatever, like shots where you're playing a video game and the player's on fire or whatever, and you just pull up from ridiculous pace. So that was pretty cool to watch the 36, 37-year-old Taurasi take over the game like that. But then the Storm did get it back in hand, and they ended up winning in overtime. So it wasn't quite enough, but it was still a ton of fun to watch before.
Nice. Yeah, so let me, who are the, maybe give the listeners a comparison, like the four teams who are left. You don't have to compare them to like an NBA team, but maybe like, I know you said that the LA and Minnesota who'd been to the last few finals aren't in it, but like.
They're like the Warriors and Cavs or something. Okay. The last three finals for them. And, except less one-sided, I guess, than Warriors and Cavs, because they were more going back and forth with who's winning.
Yeah.
And then the Storm, I would almost say they're like, I don't know, because they're a mix of young and old. So Sue Bird, who's their star point guard, is on the tail end of her career. She was kind of Taurasi's generation. And then Brianna Stewart, their MVP, and Jewel Lloyd, who's probably their third best player, are on the much younger side.
Yep.
So they're like an up-and-coming potential future dynasty. So maybe like the 2014-15 Warriors, where like, oh, this team could win a title, and we don't even know what could happen after that because so many of their best players are young.
Yeah.
Or like the early 2000s Spurs. What's really fun about some of these teams is the versatility of their star players. So both Deladon and Stewart, who are you know, two of the last three MVPs in the WNBA are like power forwards who are among the taller players on the court, but they're hitting a bunch of threes and bringing the ball up the court and throwing passes. So it's very, I don't know, who's an NBA player who's, I'm blanking on who the big guy, like, I don't know, Lauri Markkanen's coming into my head because he's a Chicago guy, but I guess like Durant. I really think Deladon reminds me a lot of Durant. Yeah, so I guess the Mystics, I don't know if this is quite the right compare. They're not like the Thunder because there isn't really a Westbrook to Deladon's Durant, but they're kind of centered around this one really tall, she's 6'5", which is, you know, like in the distribution about the same as being like 6'11 in the NBA or something. And so they're built around this like 6'5 three-point shooter who the offense kind of runs through, and everyone else gets shots with Deladon like coming off screens or getting double teamed.
So have you seen similar trends in the WNBA with a like switch to, you know, three-point centric offenses, and like have you seen?
So actually, I don't have the data to back this up, although I'm looking at yesterday's box scores. The Mystics only took, the Dream only took 10 threes out of their 68 field goal attempts. The Mystics took 20 out of their 70 field goal attempts. Obviously, this is just one game.
Yeah.
The Storm took 19 threes out of 77 field goals, and the Mercury the same, 19 out of 75. So, quickly doing some math in my head, I think actually the three-point shooting rates of the top teams are much lower mm-hmm. in the WNBA, and the post-up is still a much bigger part of the game. And I think part of the reason for that is that height is actually a bigger advantage in the WNBA than the NBA, even though the taller players are less tall, because I think the shorter NBA players get more hops, get higher in the air than the taller WNBA players, and or than like the shorter WNBA players. And so I think actually women's basketball at the professional level is more like 90s NBA right now. And there's a few teams that are starting to break that trend a little bit, but they're not quite there. Like these teams that are actually left in the finals and in the semifinals, especially the three other than the Mercury, who still post up Brittany Griner a ton, are a little bit more perimeter oriented, but like both the Sparks and the Lynx from the last few years are pretty post oriented. So this is getting towards our next conversation that we want to have on about the NBA, which is the evolution of strategy over time and where we think, I'm really interested to talk about where we think the next 5 or 10 years are going to go as defenses and offenses keep evolving back and forth.
Yeah. Well, that I think we'll save that conversation for another week because it'll be a longer discussion, but we should encourage the listeners to tweet at us and share their theories or their questions about where they think, what they think the next strategy revolution in the NBA will be. But
yeah, we got big game threes coming up on Thursday.
So what's your finals
tomorrow night?
What's your finals prediction?
I mean, so the Storm are up 2-0.
Yeah.
The next two games are in Phoenix, and, you know.
In the finals, do they play five-game series or three?
It's best of five in the finals. The semifinals are also best of five.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, the Storm are up 2-0. Next two games are in Phoenix. Taurasi and Griner are not going to go away quietly. I think the Storm probably win it, but it probably goes to game five. And then on the other side, I think if Deladon's healthy, I really favor the Mystics in that matchup. I think the Dream are a little bit. I just think the Mystics are better. I guess, but it looks like Deladon's not going to be 100%. So I think the Dream probably pulled that one out.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, we'll get an update from you on that next week. I did want to ask, because I don't know if listeners to this podcast and the Third String podcast realize that our fantasy football draft is coming next week. And I think we're going to try to like have a podcast on Third String of you, me, Pete, and Zach doing our fantasy football draft in the first few rounds, sort of like a live podcast reaction to our draft. But you were sharing with me that you are pretty into fantasy basketball, which I've never really gotten into. I've tried to play twice, but just kind of it didn't have the same allure as fantasy football because a lot of lineup switching. Maybe the stats weren't as seamless or as straightforward as just touchdowns and rushing yards and receiving yards, etc. So give me your quick case for why you like fantasy basketball.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I love fantasy basketball relative to how much I love basketball. I sort of do it because I really like the people in the league I'm in. We have an auction draft, which I think is a ton of fun from a strategy perspective to prepare for. Actually, I think two of our league people are some of our regular listeners to this podcast.
I'll give them one
thing about fantasy that's really cool in general is that it gives you a reason to care about every player on every team.
Yeah.
Because there's always going to be some teams that I don't really watch and don't really find interesting. And because of fantasy, like, I always want to know who might be an up-and-coming surprise for every team, even in the middle of the season, because there's, you know, trades and waiver wire and stuff.
Yeah, I'll give you a hint. Quincy Pondexter. Spend all of your money on Quincy Pondexter.
That is not good advice. The thing that's, I think, a bummer about fantasy basketball, which I think this is even more true of baseball, is just, in my view, the stats that are measured are less and less correlated with, like, the impact on a game. So fantasy football, I feel like touchdowns are probably pretty overrated. Like, you know, a lot of guys are getting a ton of fantasy points for converting from the 2-yard line when their team, it didn't really improve their team's win probability by that much because their team's probably going to score no matter who got the ball at the 2-yard line. So there's still some problems in football, but at least, like, yardage and touchdowns are, I don't know, they're not, like, bad statistics. It's maybe bad that defense and offensive line and stuff are underrated. But in basketball, you know, now we're getting back into the data thing, but fantasy, it rewards, like, guys like Zach LaVine over guys like Manu Ginobili or Luol Deng or whatever.
Yeah.
Which I find a little annoying. I think that problem's even worse in baseball. Like, batting average is a ridiculous statistic.
It is interesting, and I know this is the basketball podcast on the Vernacular Network, but as far as football goes, you know, there are defensive stars in the NFL, J.J. Watt, who are arguably as big a stars as many of the offensive guys, and people really love several, you know, lots of defensive players in the NFL. But we always joke in my fantasy football league that I've played in the last 14 years that we're going to add defensive individual players. And it's always just like something we joke about that would be, you know, terrible, but I don't really know why that's terrible and why that's looked as such a, I don't know, so taboo.
I think it's terrible because there's
fantasy football
11 starters on 32 teams. So that's another 350 players you have to learn. Like, it's already hard for me every August to figure out who I want to draft past, like, player number 60 in the draft. And with, like, an additional 350 potential draftees, I just feel like the amount of time to amount of fun ratio would get out of whack.
Yeah.
Which is kind of one of the arguments for fantasy basketball, is like every team's only got like 3 or 4 relevant guys for the most part. And so you don't really, unless you're in a really deep league or whatever, you can really not have to go crazy learning about the ninth man on every. Of course, I know about the ninth man on every NBA team because it's like my obsession.
Yeah.
But you don't have to, and you don't have to. I think you don't have to go deeper than you would want to go. Just if you're trying to casually watch some other games, have a rooting interest in certain players, have a reason to learn about all the teams instead of just the contenders and your favorite team.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well,
but also the trash talk, right? Like, that's key.
Yeah. Especially, yeah, we've been playing with our fantasy football league with my friends from high school for 14 years, and I had our draft on Saturday night. And I think fantasy football has lost some of its allure because there's so much corporate knowledge out there to where, you know, people don't do that many ridiculous things anymore, which is sort of what made fantasy football fun back in the day. And we have one guy in our league who is named Wildfire, who has played, he's one of our friends from high school, and he's played with us, you know, all 14 years that we played. And he infamously, Reggie Bush's rookie year, took Reggie Bush number one overall over Larry Johnson and LaDainian Tomlinson, but had sort of been a little bit more tame the past few years, but came out in full wildfire force on Saturday night and drafted six quarterbacks in an auction draft. The best one being Tom Brady, who he traded away for Juju Smith-Schuster during the draft. So crazy things can still happen in fantasy football. So maybe we'll have some stories after our third.
It's also interesting how fantasy league behavior might differ depending on who's in your league. Like, I imagine the trash talk and the message boards and the draft chat window for high school friends, certainly in my experience, for high school friend leagues look pretty different than for, in my case, my basketball league is a work people league. So I definitely would not say the same things, because I'm not trying to get in trouble with, you know, people who are could get me in trouble.
Oh, 100%.
High school friends can't get me in trouble. Yeah. So.
And people are just baffled by the fact that we've played for 14 years and we've never played for any amount of money. It's just totally pride. And Wildfire, who drafted the six quarterbacks, is the only person who's an original member of the league who's never won. So maybe this year, one of the six quarterbacks that he drafted can only start one, but will lead him to his first championship. So we'll hit us up on Twitter at Takes of the Game and let us know any questions that you have and where you think the next frontier strategy-wise in the NBA is headed. I think we're also going to give our league pass team rankings in the next couple weeks. And as I'm saying that, I just got sad of a potential lineup that on the Spurs that's going to consist of DeJounte Murray, DeMar DeRozan, Quincy Pondexter, Rudy Gay, and LaMarcus Aldridge. So they should probably just maybe like all hold hands and just like stand, do like a flying V Mighty Ducks style, just all like just come up with some new formation that's never been seen before, because there's going to be no spacing in that lineup.
Pondexter's probably actually like their third or fourth best 3-point shooter, right? Like,
I mean, I think
he's better. Bryn, Patty,
Bellinelli,
and Bertans, and Bellinelli. So he's like their fifth best 3-point shooter, I guess.
And I mean, I would probably put LaMarcus up there too. So
I guess it depends how healthy Pondexter is. He's a pretty good shooter when healthy.
Yeah. I remember sort of being scared of him in the 2013 Western Conference Finals against the Grizzlies, but yeah, that was 5 years ago.
I remember yapping about how I thought he was overrated when he was at Washington.
Nice. Cool. Well, that's it for Takes of the Game this week. I'm going to go watch Manu Ginobili YouTube highlights, probably until we talk again next week, Ishan.
Cool. I'm going to go watch the Stanford football opener in 48 hours.
Nice. Who are y'all playing?
San Diego State.
Sweet. Well, good luck with that. We will talk to you guys next week.